Well, here we are on Pentecost weekend. The Holy Day is tomorrow, and the weekly Holy Day that preempts it is today. If you read my pastor's Sabbath note, or if you've had time, I reflected on what must have been the thoughts of our original brethren in the New Testament Church of God, the 12 apostles, and the total of 120. And you realize that Christ preached and traveled and expounded for 3.5 years, and in the end, he had 120 disciples, men and women. Of course, among them were some of the key ones. They were the 12 apostles and a couple of alternates, as you remember. But 120 names is what it says in Acts chapter 1, or gathered there at the Temple Mount on that day of Pentecost. So it's something to reflect back on, and what God can do through the small number, and grows and grows and grows. And yet we haven't grown exponentially in this age. That will come in the next age. God's people are the called out ones. We're the ones who have a particular understanding of God's way and of His truth that at this point the rest of the world doesn't really comprehend. Keeping Pentecost, classic case in point. You know, certain amount of homage is paid to it by different branches of nominal Christianity, but they don't comprehend the significance of it. Acts chapter 2 is kind of a mystery to them. It doesn't need to be, but it is at the moment because God hasn't opened their minds. Let's do a quick review, though, because what I want to get into, which has to do with God's law, the Ten Commandments, I'll give you the title a little bit into the sermon, so be sure you save a space for the title. It's connected to the day of Pentecost. And for that, I want to show you this. Let's go to Exodus. Starting in chapter 12, because it's in Exodus 19 that shows the connection to Pentecost. But in chapter 12, to give us the review of what we're doing, we have the Passover is planned. Passover in the days of unleavened bread. But in the process of that, God is explaining and giving to the Israelites, or giving them a calendar, or making the calendar that he wanted to use for Israel official. So he designates it specifically. And presumably, it was different than what Egypt had. Now, the Eternal spoke to Moses. This is Exodus 12:1. And Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, "This month shall be your beginning of months." Now, that means it's the first month of God's calendar. He was establishing a calendar. He didn't have to go by the calendar experts, the early astronomers back in those days. And believe me, there were many cultures had their own calendars. Many cultures had people that studied the stars and kept track of them. And they calculated calendars based on, you know, various principles that they had. Many of them did. They were remarkably intelligent, highly advanced. Of course, most of our evolutionary thinkers today think that they were knuckle-draggers and they had no idea at all what they were doing. And those are the people that believe that there was only one dark age and one age of enlightenment, the Renaissance. And that's all wrong. There have been dark ages and renaissances periodically through human history. However, God gave to Moses and Aaron, for Israel, his calendar. This is the way his holy days would be calculated. This is the beginning of months. In that first month, on the 14th day of that month, was to be the Passover. And that's listed later in the chapter, just a few lines on. And then, also in that month, one day later, or one night later, bear in mind, God began his days not in the middle of the night at midnight. He starts his days at sundown. So a day runs with the dark portion first and the light portion last. Instead of the way we do our calendars, we start in the middle of the dark and we end in the middle of the dark. God starts at sundown and he ends at sundown. So the Passover was slain right at the beginning of that day, just as the sun was setting. And before it was completely dark. It was just enough time, by the way, to butcher a lamb in that length of time. Then on the 15th day, one day later, by the time of the evening, the Israelites had gathered, and they had to amass nearly 3 million people and all their livestock and all their stuff, and they were ready to begin their march out of Egypt. Now, granted, they weren't going to get very far in just one day. They would need many days to get where they needed to go, but they would travel about as fast as the Oregon Trail traveled. 10 miles a day, maybe 12 on a good day, if it was a downhill walk for the oxen. But that's as fast as they could go. That was on the 15th day. So in the middle of the first month, we have the first day of the Passover service, and the day of the Passover, followed immediately by the first day of unleavened bread. Now, it would have taken them about the length of time of the days of unleavened bread to make their journey down the Suez drainage. Suez Canal runs from the Mediterranean today down to the Red Sea in Egypt. And that Suez Canal, the distance they would have traveled was be about the time it would take to walk for a week to get down there. And then it says that they got tangled in the mountains on the seaboard or on the seashore. And the Egyptians came charging after them in their chariots, their mobile army. And, of course, God was planning that. He planned to thoroughly weaken Egypt so that it could not be a threat to Israel for some time. And he did that by destroying their army in the Red Sea. Israel then crossed the Red Sea. The Egyptians attempted to follow them, and that was the end of the Egyptians. You have to give them credit for being brave. How many people would normally go charging down into water on the left of them and water to the right of them, towering above them? But, they did. And that was the end of the Egyptians, and the Israelites were on the other side of the Red Sea and at the edge of the Sinai Peninsula. Now, let's envision this in your picture, in your mind. I like to talk maps, and if you've got maps on the back of your Bible, you can just look at the picture. But the Sinai Peninsula is arrowhead-shaped, sort of almost triangular down at the point. And on either side of that triangle are two branches of the Red Sea. Not the main body of the Red Sea. That extends on south before it connects with the Indian Ocean. It's considerably wider than either one of the tongues or arms of the Red Sea. The arm of the Red Sea that is to the west is the one that's next to Egypt. That's called the Gulf of Suez. And you think, what, did they name it after the canal? No, they named the canal after the Gulf of Suez. The canal was dug in modern times. The other branch of the Red Sea, the other tongue or arm of it, goes up on the other side of the Sinai Peninsula and butts up against Saudi Arabia. Ultimately, it comes to a point at the top, and that point is called Eilat. And that's the name of the city up there right now. That was one of the southernmost boundaries of Israel. And it is today, actually, for the nation state of Israel, that's one of its southernmost boundaries, is right there at Eilat. And that's where it borders with Jordan. And they both have towns. Israel and Jordan have towns there at the north side of that part of the Red Sea. Some scholars, a certain school of thought, has come up with what they think is a revolutionary concept, that the Israelites didn't cross the Gulf of Suez, the one next to Egypt, but that they galloped across the Sinai Peninsula and crossed the Gulf of Eilat into Saudi Arabia. And then they explored in Saudi Arabia back when that was possible to do, and think that they found Mount Sinai over there and lots of other things. And they make their arguments, and one mountain looks like it has the top burned on it, and various and sundry other items that they have found, and they've written many books and videos on it. But one thing that pulls the rug out from under their argument, crossing the Red Sea was a massive event in Israel's history. Massive event. The Passover was massive, but there's obviously going to be retaliation, and God was dealing with that. And that crossing of the Red Sea, as we know, the symbolism of that spiritually is phenomenal. And therefore, that had to happen on the last day of unleavened bread. Now, the reason that the Arabian scholar, or he's not from Arabia, he's from Kentucky or Tennessee, I think, but originally he's not alive now. And the reason he continued to argue for crossing the other part of the Red Sea is because he didn't understand the days of unleavened bread. There had to be a reason why. You had a holy day that had to do with the beginning of the Exodus, but they were still in Egypt. You had a holy day that exited them out of Egypt and into the neighboring territory. So a great significance to that. Now, that all happened in the first month. In Leviticus 23, it tells us about counting Pentecost. So let's turn over to Leviticus. We do want to come back to Exodus briefly. Leviticus 23. These are the feasts of God. You'll proclaim at their appointed times. But it tells how we are to count from the days of unleavened bread to come up with the day of Pentecost, which is also called the Feast of First Fruits. The New King James labels the wave sheaf offering as a Feast of First Fruits. That wasn't the wave sheaf, was not the feast. It was the beginning of the harvest. The Feast of First Fruits, or Pentecost, comes at the end of the spring harvest. And you think, what in the world do you harvest in the spring? Well, in a country like that, you plant winter grains, winter barley and winter wheat. We don't do that so much in Ohio, maybe a little. But when you go to Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and a little bit to down into Oklahoma, I'm sure, winter wheat is one of the huge grain crops in America. They plant the wheat in the fall, and it comes up, get a little tiny stand, maybe a couple of inches or so high, and then it goes dormant with the onset of winter. However, in the spring, it fires back to life. There's no germination time. As soon as it warms up, it's ready to go, and it grows, and you end up with a spring harvest. That spring harvest ends in Montana. We still live there, so we saw the harvesting companies. They would have their grain trucks pulling trailers with combines on them, and then other trucks would be pulling the headers of the combines, which as time went by, they got wider and wider, and I don't know what they are now, but when I was in the farm equipment business for a time, 32 feet wide. That's a big swath of a grain field. They were big, big combines, and they made much bigger ones since then. And they finished that in early July in Montana because they started harvesting down in Oklahoma and Kansas, and then they worked their way up through Nebraska and the Dakotas and come into Montana. So in Israel, it was actually earlier because it was more like it was a little warmer and drier, more similar to Oklahoma or Kansas perhaps. So by the time of Pentecost, you had finished the spring harvest substantially. Thus, it was a harvest festival. It was a recognition of that harvest, just like the Feast of Ingathering, which has another name, Feast of Tabernacles, is to give God thanks for the harvest, for the autumn harvest, the big harvest, which includes all the other fruits and vegetables and other grains that are grown during the summer. So here we have the wave sheaf is something that occurred during the days of unleavened bread. The days of unleavened bread are 7 days long, which means there's always going to be a Sabbath contained in the days of unleavened bread. And then there's going to be a morrow after the Sabbath. We call it Sunday today, but that's not the name that God called it. But there's always a day after the Sabbath that's within the days of unleavened bread. On occasion, that Sabbath is actually the first holy day, but that's still within the days of unleavened bread. And so Pentecost is counted beginning with that Sunday right afterwards. And then you count 50 days or 7 weeks and then a day essentially is what it is. So this goes on to explain that in verses 15 and 16. In the King James it says, "And ye shall count unto you from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that ye brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be complete. Even unto the morrow after the 7th Sabbath, ye shall number 50 days. 50 days, or 7 weeks and a day. So Pentecost is also called the Feast of First Fruits because of the end of the spring harvest. It is also called the Feast of Weeks because of counting the 7 weeks. And then the word Pentecost is Greek. It comes from 50 count, Penta, meaning 50, cost, meaning count. All meaning exactly the same day, and this is obviously where you get the Pentecost, the 50 days that are mentioned there in that passage. So Pentecost was another important holy day. Now let's go back to Exodus. Follow along with this, and then we get into the big event of the law. Now let's go back to chapters 14 and 15, not to pick a particular word, but chapter 14 is the crossing of the Red Sea, which we believe would have been on the last day of unleavened bread. And then we have the Song of Moses in chapter 15, celebrating that event. Manna is brought about. God begins to send the manna in chapter 16, manna being the bread from heaven, as it were, that they could go out, and miraculously it was there every day, except on the Sabbath. Chapter 18, we have another incident, and this is where Jethro, this is not the Jethro of the Beverly Hillbillies, to those of you who watch old TV shows, but this is Jethro, the father-in-law of Moses, to be the father of Zipporah, his wife. He was also called Reuel, he had another name. And he came and watched what Moses was doing, and Moses spent all day long making judgments among the thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of the Israelites. And there were obviously going to be differences, and he had to sort them all out. And he said, you know, you're going to wear yourself out doing this. He said, here's what you need to do. You need to organize. And he lists here, and Jethro was brilliant, a great wise man indeed. Notice verse 21. Moreover, he said, you need to select from all the people able men. Able men. What kind of men would it be? Well, men who fear God. It makes you wonder, where'd Jethro get this wisdom? He was a Midianite. And not all the Midianites were friendly to Israel, by the way, but some of them were. In fact, it would be the descendants of Jethro that moved. They stayed with Israel. They acted as guides in the wilderness and ultimately migrated right into the promised land, and they lived there and they became famous. One of them was a lady named Jael, who brought an end to a very evil and dangerous commander of the northern Canaanite Empire. His name was Sisera. Used a tent peg. There was another famous one named Jonadab the Rechabite, much later, who was an advisor to King Jehu of Israel. And by the time of Jeremiah, the descendants of Jonadab were called the Rechabites. And they came, and Jeremiah had a special meeting with them. Very famous. And these were all Midianites, a branch of Midian. Not the branch that was against Israel, but the ones that were for them. So able men who fear God, men of truth, who hate covetousness, and you'll place such over them, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of ten. And then when there's a judgment that needs to be made, then they make it at the lowest level possible. And if they're stumped, they hand it up the line. And you think, well, that sounds like our court system. You know, it's municipal courts, and if they get stumped there, then it goes up. Ultimately, we've got the Supreme Court in America. It's similar, very similar structure. This one was to be guided more by God in Moses' day. So that's what they did. And now we come to chapter 19. In the third month after the Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on the same day they came to the wilderness of Sinai, where they had departed from Rephidim. And that Rephidim is where they had a battle with the Amalekites, who attacked them there. They had come, departed from Rephidim and had come to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness. So Israel camped there before the mountain. The mountain was Mount Sinai. In the third month. Well, if the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread are in the middle of the first month, 14th day for Passover, 15th day for the first day of unleavened bread, then somewhere during the Days of Unleavened Bread, there is the day that begins the counting process for the day of Pentecost. And every one of the years in the Hebrew calendar is 29 to 30 days long, because a lunar month is about 29 and a half days in length. So you end up with, say, 30 days and maybe 13 or so days from the Days of Unleavened Bread. And then the remainder of the 50, 30 and 13 is 43, you got about a week's worth more. is going to land in the third month. Thus, the Jewish tradition is that God spoke the Ten Commandments on the day of Pentecost, the Feast of First Fruits or the Feast of Weeks. Now, when you stop and think about it, if God commemorated the Exodus, commemorated the Passover, the death of the firstborn, the tenth plague, the worst plague, the next day was the Exodus with the holy day, and then the by that reasoning, the day of crossing the Red Sea was a holy day, then when God spoke His law to Israel, literally spoke to them, terrified them, and so they said, Moses, you go talk to God and come and tell us what He said. We're terrified. But the speaking was already done. That was establishing the old covenant with Israel. They agreed. God agreed, and He says, here's my standard. It's the Ten Commandments. That's what He spoke. So the giving of God's law. Now, the law existed before, but here it was in an official relationship with a part of mankind. The giving of God's law, and after He spoke it, it was written down. Actually, God wrote it down on the tables of stone and gave it to Moses. Those are, unfortunately, the ones that Moses broke when he threw them down because of the rebellion of the Israelites when he came down the mountain, but then he went back up and they got another set. And that's all unfolds in the rest of Exodus. So it was, He was calling Israel out to be an example. He wanted them to be, in verse 6 of chapter 19, you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. And these are the words that you'll speak to the children of Israel, He says to Moses. This is what I want for them to do. And he, in chapter 20 then, when he actually meets with Israel, we go over to chapter 20, the Lord spoke all these words saying, I am the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. The commandment was, you shall have no other gods before me. You, or in the King James, thou shalt not. Now here, this brings us to our topic. Now that we have it tied directly into Pentecost, and you stop and think about what the, you know, the build-up for God to give His law and establishing that old covenant. It wasn't called the old covenant then, of course, but it became, by historical retrospect, it's the old covenant, because we're under the new covenant now. You begin to understand something about the law, that there are a lot of thou shalt nots. 80% of the Ten Commandments are stated in the negative form. You shall not, you shall not, you shall not. In fact, that bothers some people. How can you worship a God that says no all the time and not all the time? Well, that's a fair question. So I want us to look at, and here's your title, God's Ten Positive Commandments. They're not negative. When you understand them in perspective, and when you begin to look at the effect of them, they're very positive. God's Ten Positive Commandments. It's time that we really come to appreciate and value God's law, and to translate the thou shalt nots into the brilliant ideal of thou shalt. What is the law really saying? Now, it's an emotional reaction when people say, I don't want you to tell me no all the time. Mostly they're spoiled. But some people who have been burdened down with abuses of different kinds, I can appreciate the fact that they have trouble reacting to that. They have been beaten down badly. So we cut them slack. For the rest of us, we're spoiled. We don't like being told no. But when you realize God isn't just telling us no. He's telling us a whole lot more than that. And you begin to see how wonderfully positive God's commandments are. So we'll start with commandment number one. But first we need to keep our hand there and look in 1 John chapter 5. Here's the premise. Bear in mind, you take the whole scripture together. 1 John is way back nearing Revelation after Peter. Chapter 5. And verse 3. For this is, 1 John 5:3, for this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments. John wasn't, you know, suckering for the argument they were negative commandments. It was an expression of God's love. the love of God, that we keep his commandments. Christ told the disciples that in John chapter 15. He says, if you love me, keep my commandments. And it goes on to say in verse 3 of 1 John 5, the final sentence, and his commandments are not burdensome, or they're not grievous in the King James. They're not negative. Not negative? That's two negatives, isn't it? No, they're not negative. They're positive. Now we come back to the Ten Commandments. So God says in the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me. That is, before the true God. No, we normally summarize it, and you shall have no other gods before the true God, because we're not speaking from God's perspective. God is speaking from his perspective here. You shall have no other gods before me. Now we can say, well, there's no idols then. Well, actually, the idols are covered in the second commandment more specifically. Commandment 1 and Commandment 2 overlap a little bit, which is good. But Commandment 1 is the overarching commandment. You shall have no other gods before the true God. And you think, well, that's so negative. No, it's not, because it's actually the first and great commandment. Christ himself said that in Matthew 22. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with every fiber of your being, you will love God. So it isn't a negative, it's a positive. It's marvelously positive. Now, it also tells us a lot of things. It tells us, number one, there is a true God. God is God, and God is good. We also know that God exists as a family. And that's from Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 15. Ephesians 3 and verse 15. This is very important and is overlooked by nominal Christianity because they are stumped with the Trinitarian doctrine, which the Bible doesn't teach. But it does teach divine family. Let me read it to you. Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 15. Paul, leading up to it in verse 14, for this reason I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, and then verse 15 begins in the middle of that sentence, from whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. So God is a family kingdom. Our destiny is to be a part of that family. It is open-ended, expansive. The Trinity view of the nature of God is a closed system. And you can't be part of it. So it is a divine family. Now we know, as we think about this first commandment, you shall know other gods before the true God, we know that we have some obstacles, because there is a great fallen angel. God created the angels before he created humans. And the angels had to make a decision. They had to establish their character at a certain point, and they did. And one third of them ruined their character. They chose the way of sin, the way of evil. The other two-thirds remain faithful and holy. And those we call angels. The ones who were angels before, we now call demons. Fallen angels. And the archdemon of the demons is Satan the devil. And we know that he does not like us. Everything he does is to thwart God's plan in any way that he can. Destruction is his name, and destroyer is his name, and destruction is his game. Get it right here. Also, we humans have a human nature. Now, our nature is not outgoing like God's. In just normal form, before it's influenced by the devil's thinking, our human nature is closer to neutral, but it is still fundamentally, selfishly focused. When it is infused by Satan's rebellious and evil nature, then it becomes intensely focused on self and hateful toward others, and certainly hateful toward God. You know, the carnal mind is what it's called, meaning the physical mind in Romans 8 and verse 7. The carnal mind is enmity, that means hostile to God, the law of God. It is not subject to God's law, neither indeed can it be. So we know we have to overcome that, because we all have that kind of human nature. Because we were born with the nature of man, and it was negatively, horrendously negatively influenced by the devil. So the ideal then is what would the world look like if all mankind worshipped only the true God and didn't put anything else in their lives ahead of God? Well, that would be different, wouldn't it? Possessions that people have that become a god to some, it would be put in their place. They wouldn't be anywhere near as high in their estimation as their love for God. Some people make a god out of their work. And you think, well, working's good, so I'll, you know, I've, everything goes into my work. It becomes a god. For some, it's wealth. For some, it's anger or hatred. For some, it's a school of thought, a philosophy, or an argument. For some, it's sexually immoral lusts. Those would all are put in the place of God in many cases. But if everybody were striving to obey the first commandment, it would change the world. It changes our lives. So we know it would change all lives on a massive scale. We would have faithful, happy people, happy marriages, happy families. That would be the beautiful norm of society because they worship God and everything else falls into its place, subservient to God. And that which is evil is rooted out of our lives. That's what commandment number one is. You shall not have, you know, any other God before me. Well, that means you put God first and everything else falls where it belongs. If it's a sin, it's gotten rid of. If it's a legitimate thing to have, good work, some possessions, they stay in their proper perspective. There's a peace of mind that families and individuals would have when they're obeying the first commandment. You see, what we're going to look at with each commandment, we look at the ideal. What will it? How would that change society? How would it change our lives? Let's go on to commandment number two. You shall not make any carved image to bow down and worship it. Let me read it in its entirety in Exodus. Thou shalt not make for thyself any carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth, and you shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Eternal, your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generations to those who hate me, and showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Normally we think of jealousy as a bad thing. This kind of jealousy is a good thing. Because to worship any other form of worship, other than worshiping the true God, only leads to evil and destruction. Ultimately the destruction of all mankind. Now, what's the difference between commandment one, no other gods before the true gods, and it says here, no carved image, you know, make no carved image and bow down to worship it. Because the pagan religions all made their gods. They made them out of stone, or they made them out of wood. In fact, Isaiah and Jeremiah were marvelous, sarcastic prophets. I mean, really good at the targeted sarcasm, because Isaiah goes on and Jeremiah did the same thing. You know, the woodman goes out and he cuts down a tree and he brings the log home and he cuts the log and shapes his image. But the other half of the log he puts in the fire to cook his food and to keep him warm. And then he worships what's left of the log and claims that that's his God. You know, that's, what kind of lunacy is that when you stop to think about it? What was wrong with the part you burned? Why didn't you worship it too? The tree huggers in the northwest of America do. They go for the whole tree or none. Which is another form of environmental idolatry in that sense. It is an odd thing out there. You don't have that here. We hardly have any tree huggers in Ohio. It just is. For my family, because we spent a lot of time in the Northwest over the years, it's refreshing. Because there you do. They don't want you to cut the big trees down. And they hug them. And then they climb up in the branches sometimes and build their houses up there so you can't cut them down. And down in California, they do that down there. And up in Oregon, they're not quite that big. But they, as far as I can tell, they just noticed out of their selfish little lives, they just finally noticed, wow, these trees are bigger than me. Isn't that the line that they say? I suddenly realized that life's not all about me. It's all about things that are bigger than me. So a tree's bigger than me, so I'm going to hug the tree. It must be God. That's about where they come from. It's very strange. And yet not so strange, because mankind has been doing that, except they carved the trees in those days into images, or they made them out of stone. And God said, don't do that. So essentially, commandment number two focuses largely on the form or system or structure of personal and collective worship. In other words, there were many religions that worshipped the pagan gods, whether they were made of stone or made of wood or made of gold, even in some cases. And they had their priesthoods or their priestesshoods. Some were female-dominated. It varied from place to place and time to time. And then they had their own doctrines, their own commandments, their own rules that they came up with. In other words, they created a form of religion that didn't coincide with God's form of religion. And we think, well, I'm glad we don't live in pagan times. We do. Even modern Christianity, sad to say, go back and read its history. You have copies of paganism. The holidays, the saints, as the saints are viewed by some religions, the forms, even the ceremonies, are all drawn from ancient paganism. They don't teach the true God. They either have images of God that they worship, or they worship paintings of God, depending on which group it is. But that's not what God commands. You will not make any carved image, or any flat image either, on canvas, to bow down and worship it. We worship the true God. So what is the ideal? The ideal, when the world obeys this law, is that there will be a true religious system. And what's that going to be like? How long have you been around here? We're living that true religious system. We meet today, and then we meet again tomorrow for services to worship God. We're a part of that. It will change the way buildings are made. See, there was a temple in the Old Testament. There will be a temple in the millennium. And that will be the center of official worship of God in the millennium, in Jerusalem. Christ will rule from there. Then, the new heavens and the new earth take place. There's not going to be any temple anymore, but there will be the new Jerusalem. And there won't be a temple because there isn't a need for one, because the Father and the Son will be there. And all of the resurrected family. See, it changes everything. The practices and the doctrines. This is where doctrines come in. God must be worshipped with the true doctrines, not false teachings, but the true teachings of His Word. Now, we came out, in almost every instance, except for those who grew up in the faith, came out of some religion that had false doctrines. They didn't know that, because they're in a state of deception, so we aren't blaming them specifically. They inherited a system from way back. We have inherited a system of religion too, the true religion, from God and from the apostles through Christ. Let's go on to commandment number 3. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. If you can imagine everybody worshiping the true God, and if you want to read it, I'm going to go back of commandment number 2 for a minute. I wanted to add one thing. If you want to read a short item this afternoon, read Acts 17. The sermon about the unknown God. The Apostle Paul is taught, explaining the truth, the true form of religion, to the pagan Athenians in Greece. It goes from verse 22 to 31. You can find it. It's the latter part of Acts 17. Very interesting. But now we go to commandment number 3. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Taking God's name in vain. For the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now, we normally think of that, well, that's cursing. Using God's name or cursing or sending somebody to a traditional hell, that kind of hell doesn't even exist. But still, the intent is hatred and anger and evil. It does include cursing, using foul language, generally. Taking God's name to condemn somebody, that's all wrong. We root that out of our vocabulary. And we root the euphemisms out. The Jiminy Crickets was a way of saying Jesus Christ. And any other watered-down cuss word, we don't use those. Sometimes that's a habit that's a little challenging to break if you've been one that used a lot of that kind of language. But we do break those habits. Now, there are two elements of this. It's not just the language. It is that. We'll touch more on the language. But it also is the example. We claim to be the representatives of Jesus Christ and God the Father. Do we live like that? Personally and in private? Or do we just put on a show for the public? Now, let's look at the language. I said no euphemisms of God's name, no foul language, or no anger that generates that cursing attitude. And furthermore, on the language end of not taking God's name in vain, no senseless repetition of God's name, like praise the Lord or praise Jesus every other sentence. That is making light of God's name. Or worse yet, oh my God. That might be said in a genuine sentence, in a very traumatic time in one's life, calling out to God for help in a prayer, but not the way it's used today. OMG. They don't even say it on Facebook. They just write the initials or in texting. But it means the same thing. Why do they say that? Does that make them more righteous? No, it's a habit. It's a habit they inherited, which is a pagan practice of repeating the name of a false name of God over and over. False name in the sense they're not representing the true God at all. Or thank God. Some people thank God at every other sentence. That's taking God's name in vain. God's name is respected. And when it is spoken with meaning and depth. Not just tossed out as salt and pepper in a language. Nor in cursing and anger. God would be, in the ideal, God would be referred to in the balanced and reverent way. People would speak respectfully of others because we are made in the image of God bodily. We have the same form as God, arms and legs and torso and so on and head. So we would be more respectful of other people. And that gets into the example. We should always strive to live up to God's standards and God's ways. So we carry the label of being true Christians. People ought to be able to see us and say, yeah, he really does worship his God. Everything that he or she does. Always truthful. It's an honor to be God's people, and we need to represent him in his way faithfully to others. Now, the vain repetitions make a reference to Matthew chapter 15. Let me show you a passage there that is important for us to understand. Matthew 15. The scribes and Pharisees, we're going to go to the first 9 verses of this chapter, Matthew 15. The scribes and Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus saying, "Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders, for they don't wash their hands when they eat bread?" They did wash their hands. They just didn't wash their hands to the elbow. Now you have to think, well, how deep is that loaf of bread that I have to reach into my elbow? But Christ answered their question with a question. "Why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? For God commanded, saying, 'Honor your father and mother,' and he who curses father and mother, let him be put to death. But you say, 'Whoever says to his father and mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is a gift to God.'" The word in Hebrew is korban. "Then he need not honor his father and mother. Thus you have made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition. Hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying," and let me get back to explain that, what they were doing. They would promise to make a donation to the temple treasury and tell their parents, "You're on your own in your old age. I'm not going to take care of you. I'm just making this donation to God. He's more important than you are." When God expected them to help their parents. "These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, and their heart, but their hearts are far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." Worshiping God in vain. That's taking his name in vain, amongst other commandments. Bear in mind, if you break one of the 10 commandments, you broke them all. James 2 and verse 10 is what says that. And when you begin to think about it, the commandments aren't standalones. They actually are linked together conceptually and specifically in many, many ways. Back to commandment number 4. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Whoa, that's not negative. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Where's the no? Where's the thou shalt not? It's not there. Whoops, I just said a not. It's not there, though. This is one of the 20% of the commandments that are stated positively. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Traditional Christianity, because of their argument for grace and the misunderstanding of fundamental things, they tend to look upon the law as evil. And they refer to that evil law. We don't have to keep that evil law. And yet, it's strange because they feel compelled to place the Ten Commandments in prominent places in America in particular. Our governing buildings, and now we have big controversies over all of that, and have had for some years because there are some that don't want any vestige of it at all. But when they get into their doctrinal argument, it's an evil law you don't have to keep. They don't really have a problem with the Nine Commandments when you get down to it. They believe in the Nine Commandments. It's the fourth commandment they have a problem with because it says, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. And they inherited Sunday. They inherited Sunday from, the first 300 years after Christ's ministry, because that's when traditional Christianity got its start, was after the first century was over and the influence of the apostles had waned to a certain degree. Then, true to form, you begin to have the heretics going off, to the left and to the right, and ultimately ending up with the false doctrines that traditional Christianity has inherited. They didn't create them, to be fair. They just inherited them. But they haven't seen fit to try to change their thinking. But think about the ideal of Sabbath keeping. If all mankind kept the Sabbath every week, they would work hard on 6 days, and they would all rest on the seventh day, and gather to worship God and enjoy the fellowship. That would be the true rhythm that God intended for life, for mankind. The Sabbath was made for man. We try to replicate it, but we have to hurry and scurry and drive long distances sometimes, longer at other times than always, to be able to keep God's Sabbath, or the annual Sabbaths, because they fall under the same commandment. They are Sabbaths as well. Yet we know that in the world tomorrow, there's going to be nearly one of God's churches on every corner in the city. Not every corner, but, every neighborhood. Because the whole world will keep God's way. And the rhythm of life will be deep and profound of that 6 days of labor, 1 day of rest. Now we replicate it the best we can in this age we live in, but we marvel at what the ideal will look like then. Commandment number 5, honor your father and mother that your days may be long on the land which the Lord your God gives you. Honor your father and mother. By the way, there's no negative there, is there? This is the other part of the 20% of the Ten Commandments that are positively stated. It's a positive commandment in that sense. Honoring your parents. Christ just talked about that in Matthew 15. We just looked at that. The ideal of honoring parents would be happy, faithful families. At peace with each other. At peace with God. Many people automatically envision the ideal of that kind of a family relationship, even when they're fraught with all kinds of sins and misunderstandings and problems that they have. They envision the ideal. They just don't realize it. So it's kind of built in. The Apostle Paul referred to it in Ephesians chapter 6. I don't know if you were aware of this. Preface a comment about this passage in Ephesians 6 by the fact that Leonard Nimoy died a few weeks ago, who was Spock on Star Trek. And he was famous for his Vulcan greeting. And you remember how that went? Some people can do it. Other people are genetically incapable of doing the Vulcan greeting. Some can do it with both hands. I can, but I am keeping my place in Exodus. Children, verse 1, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise. The first commandment with promise? What's the promise? Well, we read it before. That it may be well with you, and yet you may live long upon the earth. Live long and prosper. And that's what happens when families love their parents and their grandparents, and then their children growing up know that they'll be parents and their children will love them, and the ideal is in process. They will live long and they will prosper, and the next generation will prosper, and the next, and the next. It's the way God intended life on earth to be, and it will be in the millennium and in the white throne judgment. And the principle of that commandment will carry on, because ultimately God is our Father. And we honor Him. The church is our mother in that sense. Commandment number 6 now. Back to the negative ones. You shall not kill or murder. You shall not kill. God's people are not violent. This commandment should sink deeply into our thinking. We don't fight in the wars of this world. Christ Himself said that. John 18:36. You ought to memorize it. Pontius Pilate said, are you a king then? He says, I am. Yeah, he explained he was a king. He says, why aren't your people, you know, defending you? He says, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom isn't from here. So they don't fight. And some say, well, Peter carried a sword. The night before Christ said that, Peter carried a sword and cut off the ear of the high priest. Is that what Christ meant for him to do? No. He said, he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. And he put the ear back. Peter carried the sword so that they would be called thieves and robbers. It was a prop. Because Christ said, do you have a sword? And somebody said, well, here's two. He says, that's plenty. And then they went out from the room, down to the valley, Garden of Gethsemane, in the valley between the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives, and that's where Christ was arrested. And because there were two weapons with his group, they were labeled as thieves and robbers, which fulfilled a prophecy in Isaiah. And Christ was specifically fulfilling all of the prophecies he'd inspired to be seated through the Old Testament, and that was one that had to be done. Peter went got out of hand and was sharply rebuked because of that. In Matthew chapter 5, and I'll leave this for your own reading, it's in verses 21 to 26, Christ expands the meaning of you shall not kill. You shall not hate, because if you hate, you have murder in your heart. You have already committed the sin in your mind. Hating your brother or fellow human being is the same thing as killing. So we can't even hate. What's the fun in that? Well, what's the fun in hating? It's not fun. What's the ideal then? It is ideal is that you honor, respect, and have genuine outgoing concern for all people. No wars, only world peace. I mean, truly world peace. You know, sometimes it's joked about, because that's what people want. Intuitively, they want world peace. They just don't know how to get it. Well, this would be a good start. Don't kill anybody, and don't even hate anybody, and we'll begin to make some serious progress. Commandment number 7, you shall not commit adultery. Adultery here is the way of referring to any and all sexual immorality. Any and all. The sexual and drug revolutions, number 1 and number 2, we're in number 2, number 1 was in the 1960s, both make the preposterous and idiotic claim that as long as you quote-unquote love someone, then sex with that person of whatever gender is not something to feel guilty for. Wrong. There's a lecherous devil that is deceiving mankind. And he desires right now to destroy the biblical marriage. You shall not commit adultery. All he does is he foists off on mankind the concepts of adultery. They can't think of their sexuality, anything except adulterous relations of one kind or another. Now, Christ also expanded on the meaning there in Matthew 5. Matthew 5 Some think that, you know, when Christ was doing away with the law by explaining the spirit of the law, wrong. He was expanding the law by explaining what the Ten Commandments fully meant. He said, if you lust after somebody, lusting is selfish sexually desiring someone that isn't your spouse in marriage, as defined by the Bible, that's adultery already. The attitude is adultery. It's the same sin. And it needs to be rooted out of our lives and our thinking. Now, what's the ideal of a world that doesn't commit adultery? Well, number one, wonderful, solid, happy marriages, which will then be producing healthy, faithful, happy children. Now, it creates an incredibly strong society that is resilient and that it cares for others. Now, you can read about in the Song of Solomon, you get an inkling of the ideal righteous sexual desire in marriage. God elaborated on it. He had that expounded and written in a beautiful poetic way. Someday we'll do a Bible study on that. I have given a number of those. It's quite interesting. But that's commandment number 7. You shall not commit adultery. And we live in a world that just is doing one adulterous revolution after another. In our time. Commandment number 8. You shall not steal. So you think, okay, so what's the ideal of not stealing? What's it going to be like if nobody stole anything? Did you lock your car? You won't have to. You know, I mean, back in the day when, you know, different societies have been much more honest in this respect at other times. How many times did they lock their buggies? Or, hold it, I forgot to lock up my horse, Lone Ranger said as he went out and padlocked Silver to the hitching post. No, you didn't do that. People didn't look very favorably on horse thieves in early America. So there have been times when this law has been obeyed to a large extent in many respects. But if everybody respected that which belonged to other people, they would be treating personal ownership of something as a sacred value. It isn't mine. It belongs to him or her or them. I'm going to take it back to them because it belongs to them. Abraham Lincoln is often called Honest Abe. I think he walked, I forget how many miles it was to read. He had made the wrong change at a store he was working at when he was a young man. And so he walked miles and miles and miles to get to the family who had overpaid by 2 or 3 cents to return the money. Because he wasn't going to take money that didn't belong to it. So that was a great example. I found out when my father died a couple of years ago, he was 90 years old. My brother had worked with him a lot longer than I had, because when I was 18, I went on to college, and Marshall stayed on the farm or in the logging woods near the farm. But my dad had developed what my brother described, a painfully honest reputation among the neighbors. That's the way they described it, and they highly respected him for it. So we have examples of honesty, and that is not stealing. Commandment number 9, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. In short, you shall not lie. We live in a lying, cheating, stealing, two-time and double-dealing, mean-streeting society. To quote a line out of a country and western song, the title of which I can't remember, but I love the line. Shading the truth to make yourself look good or to gain influence, that's lying. False doctrines are lying about the Bible, about what the Bible says. So what's the idea? What if nobody lied? And they ask you, well, how do I look today? And they said, awful. No, that's not being honest. That's not being loving, you know. Maybe they need to straighten their tie or their rooster tail in the back of their head is sticking up for a guy. You know how it is when you get a cowlick. I don't know if you ever called them that, but where the hair swirls, that's called a cowlick. At least it's called a cowlick where I come from, which there are a lot of cows. And you knew that a cow was healthy if it licked itself. One of the things my father used to teach me on the farm, he had a small feedlot. And we had stock cows out in the pasture where, you know, they spent the summer and raising calves and whatnot. When we were anywhere near our cattle, we were to watch them, and he would teach us what to watch for. When they get up, do they stretch? If they don't stretch, go check them. They're sick. They always stretch when they get up, unless they have to jump and run. But if they're just getting up from rest, they will stretch. And you wonder, how can they stretch like that? Well, if we tried it, we would probably put most chiropractors out of business. Stretching is a good thing. And he said, look at their noses. If the nose is not shiny, they got a fever. Especially calves, little calves, but even with a bigger animal. He says, if you see animals out apart from the rest of the herd, they're herd animals. And if they're not with the herd, there's a problem, or there's a reason at least. A cow ready to have a calf, drop a calf, will typically remove herself from the herd to have the calf. So that's one thing we're checking for. We had stock cows, meaning that we had cows who had calves, and we raised the calves and so on. So we're always watching for that. But otherwise, if they're not having a calf, they're probably not feeling good. So you go check on them. And then the other thing, he said, you start looking as you wander through the herd, look at their sides. Do they show where they've licked themselves? Now, a full-size cow or a bull, doesn't matter, they can swing around and get their nose clear back on the inside of their hip. That's part of the reason why they don't need chiropractors too, I suppose. And they lick their hair. And you get these licks. Those are called calyx. And you can tell where their tongue has licked their hair. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, if they can do that, they're feeling good. If they got a bellyache, they can't do that. Or if they are injured in some way. So the cow lick is, sometimes it's a good thing, but not when you're trying to get your hair to stay down. So if somebody says, how do I look? You say nicely. You look great. Let's fix your hair. Being painfully honest is sometimes not being kind and loving. You explain, be truthful always, though. The ideal is the truth always and everywhere. The truth always and everywhere. You don't have to doubt somebody's word. They're going to tell you the truth. That's the positive of God's commandment. Commandment number 10, you shall not covet. What shall you not covet? You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant. Most of us don't have male and female servants, butlers and maids. We have doorbells and stoves that don't need to have fire carried in or fuel carried in. They just go flip a switch and it's on. So we don't normally, you know, our strata of society doesn't have that. But still, you don't covet, you know, a really good butler or a really good cook. You would, you know, somebody might covet that. Nor you shall you covet his ox or his donkey or anything that is your neighbor's. You know, the Ten Commandments have both a physical and spiritual obedience component. However, coveting is all spiritual. You know, we talk about the letter of the law, and you can see in the other nine commandments the letter of the law. But when you get to the tenth commandment, there isn't a letter of the law because it's not an action that's taken with the hand. All the other commandments can be taken, action can be taken, but with coveting, it's all in the head. That's what coveting is. Because you say, well, what if I take it because I coveted it? Well, then you stole. But you didn't steal until you coveted. You see, coveting is the spirit of the law. Interestingly, in the letter of the law in the Ten Commandments, as they were given to Israel, there was a spirit of the law commandment right at the end that takes into account all of what was going to come in the new covenant when God would write his law in our hearts and minds. And we're going to get to that in a minute. In fact, give you an example. It's in Colossians 3 and verse 5. I'll read it to you. Colossians 3 and verse 5. You want to note it down. Therefore, put to death your members, Paul said, which are on the earth, your behaviors, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Hold it. Idolatry was commandment 1 and then commandment 2. So you mean the commandment 10 links around to commandment 1 and 2? Yes, it does. The law is a chain. Every commandment's a link, and they're all linked together. You break one, you've broken them all. It's a marvelous, wonderful, fantastically positive law. So what's the ideal? What would life be like if people didn't covet? They didn't desire what you have. Didn't, you know, scheme and calculate how they could get what you have. Like everybody's calculating to get what, of all things, Burma has right now. I had dinner with the Showers the other evening, and the sextons there, Leon and Gloria, were there from Thailand. And he was explaining to me the importance of Burma. Gold, silver, petroleum, vast quantities. China wants it. India wants it. The West wants it. They all covet what Burma has. Well, if we didn't have that, we would have the ideal of those who obey the law of not coveting. People who are thankful for and satisfied with what they have. And who don't selfishly desire anything that belongs to their fellow man. They're glad they have it. We're happy for you. That's a totally different way of looking at the Ten Commandments. It's not a thou shalt not. It's that this is what shall be. The Ten Commandments, in a sense, are a prophecy of God's world, and ultimately a prophecy of the kingdom of God. It's all in how you look at it, all how you analyze it and marvel at it. And then we conclude with Hebrews chapter 8. In Hebrews chapter 8, it was the old covenant when God gave the Ten Commandments to the Israelites there at Mount Sinai. It will be the new covenant that would come in Acts chapter 2 on the day of Pentecost. Then, the covenants came the same time. Same time of year. Hebrews chapter 8. And here's a long quotation in my New King James. It's all in italics because it is directly quoted from Jeremiah 31, which is the New Covenant chapter. It says, Paul starts out and says in verse 7, because if the first covenant had been faultless, then no place would have been sought for the second. Because finding fault with them, the fault wasn't with the covenant, it was with Israel. Finding fault with them, he says, behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not according to the covenant I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they did not continue in my covenant, and I disregarded them, says the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Eternal. I will put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts. They will internalize my laws. My commandments. Suddenly, the Ten Commandments delivered as the core of the Old Covenant become the core of the New Covenant, but with greater intent and greater purpose and greater depth and greater positive application. And none of them, verse 11, will teach his neighbor and his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. For I'll be merciful to their unrighteousness and their sins and their lawless deeds I'll remember no more. There's a wonderful, exciting, marvelous time ahead, pictured by this Holy Day weekend that we're right in the middle of here, looking forward to Pentecost tomorrow. A time when we can see in action God's positive Ten Commandments.